Again tonight, cosmology part two, and as we always do, we sort of just set the stage for the big picture. This 20-week series, think about that, 5 months of science, good grief, you guys are hardcore, been examining the relationship between science and faith, and we did a lot of historical survey there for the first, 2 or 3 months. But 3 weeks ago, we made a shift, and we're trying to look at now what is the current state of science in some areas. Again, we can't cover everything. And then also, how do these relate to our faith? So this part, we started 3 weeks ago, if you remember, geology, paleontology, which is the study of fossils, and this whole idea of deep time. And as recently as the mid-1800s, everybody, including scientists, thought the world was only about 6,000 years old. So the idea, we were talking a little bit earlier about how far galaxies are away and how much time for that light to get to us. So that's a pretty darn recent insight, in terms of our knowledge. Then 2 weeks ago, we looked at four papers that Albert Einstein wrote in what is referred to as the miracle year of 1905, where he essentially kind of lays the groundwork for pretty much everything that's followed that. That night we focused more intensely though on the theories of relativity. First the specific theory of relativity in 1905, and then the general theory of relativity in 1915. And it's out of the general theory of relativity that the material that we're looking at now has come. So nice little chart over here. Just ignore the math part of it. Look at the pretty pictures part. Last week, we turned to how relativity laid the foundations for what is called modern cosmology, or if you look up there at the top, the history of the universe. That's essentially what we're talking about. Focusing on what is called the Big Bang, which is the prevailing theory, consensus theory at the moment. And the idea that the universe not only had a sudden, violent beginning, but since then it's had a very orderly progression that we actually can study and look at empirically in many ways. There's another development that we want to turn to that arises out of Einstein's math, the theory of general relativity, as well as the work of Friedman and Lemaître that we looked at last week. This is another theory that actually grows out of the Big Bang theory, out of Hubble's work and the math that goes with that. And it's predicated on this other aspect of the theory that we sort of set off the table last week simply because there wasn't enough time to get into it. And it is simply this: the universe evidences orderly development. Now that may not sound like a fairly radical statement, but once you begin to look at it, it is one of the more radical statements of physics. You've probably seen at some point something that looks like this, sort of laying out. You've got the Big Bang, the big light flash there. You've got in a period there, the quantum fluctuations when there is so much energy, the heat is so high that nothing exists, nothing matter-wise, not even the basic building blocks of matter. And then things cool down, some things begin to form, and there's a period called the Dark Ages. As things are cooling down, we still don't have any stars or any light. And then you have the stars and stuff. So let me break this down a little bit. Here's the order of progression. Initially, you're going to have something called the Big Bang. How that came to be, where it comes from, all those kinds of questions we simply could not answer. But all the empirical evidence, the redshift, the residual radiation, the things that we can see in space through spectrography, all the evidence indicates that the universe began 14.85 billion years ago with a tremendous explosion. We have an initial period here. You can see the chart on the side where there is so much energy that basically nothing physical can exist. It's all pure energy. And even like quarks and gluons and anti-quarks and mesons and baryons and all those kinds of things, that will eventually make up the universe, there's a point there where they don't even exist. but they emerge out of this. A couple of theories. One is this is a bubbling. You can see that in the orange. Another one is that it's a smooth, and that's in the yellow, and there's a third option there. So, of course, a lot of this is speculative because we were not there. As this cools, the building blocks of matter start to form, you know, eventually, the basic building blocks of what we call matter, electrons, neutrons, protons. Of course, you also have photons for light. And you can see there, you got in the chart, the bottom half, you got the inflation, you've got protons form, nuclear fission begins, and then you can see over there on the right, eventually you're gonna get galaxies. As the universe continues to cool, these things, it cools enough that the basic building blocks of matter of the universe can exist, and so they start to form. And we begin to get the simpler elements. The best guess is we're talking about essentially the universe is made of hydrogen, plus some helium and plus lithium. Those, of course, are the three lightest, three simplest elements. Gravity will then cause these hydrogen atoms that form to begin to coalesce, and they begin to clump together and more and more and more. We get to the point we have something that can become a star. This is a first generation star. So much matter comes together and gravity causes it to force together. The pressure and the intensity gets so much that it causes heat, and there's a point at which you have an ignition if you have enough matter together of a star. This is called a first generation star. These stars, like the stars today, they'll ignite. They burn primarily hydrogen in the process called fusion. And when the hydrogen is eventually used up, there's not enough pressure outwards, and gravity causes everything to collapse inwards and then results in a titanic explosion. Depending on the size of the star, that will either be a nova or a supernova, if the stars are big enough. It is in these titanic explosions that the heavier elements are then produced. They don't exist in the first generation stars. But we get things like carbon and oxygen and nitrogen, and this is what we would today call stardust. It's interesting because we can, through spectrography, look into the heavens today, even between the galaxies. And here you see a spectrograph done. And here's some of the things that are simply floating out there in space. Quite an intricate mixture. And if you've had a little bit of biochemistry, you know that you may be looking at some of the building blocks of life. We have complicated organic compounds. Once you've had the first series of stars live their lives, they nova, supernova, if they're big enough, throw the gas out there, including the heavier elements. Again, gravity causes it to coalesce, and they're going to gradually come back together, and this will produce the second generation of stars. And at this point, because there's heavier elements, you can have what's called a planetary disk. So not everything goes, most of it goes into the sun in the middle of the star, but you're going to have extra material, particularly the heavier materials, that form a ring, and out of these planets will come. And again, this material contains the basic building blocks of life. We looked at this earlier, but this is one of the most remarkable discoveries of science ever. This is the Murchison meteorite. Fell in the 1960s, but it's only been the last just handful of years it's actually been dated. And we now have an accurate dating of it 7 billion years. Figure that our solar system is 4.5 billion years old. Well, 4.5, 5.5, 6.5, 2.5 billion years older than our solar system. So this would have been left over from a previous explosion. This is one example of what is called a stellar condensate. This is the stuff that's out there, you know, that clumped together. It's not the only example we have, but I think this is the oldest one we know so far. This is, in fact, the residue from a star going nova that then collapses together out there in space. Now, here's some of what was found in this meteorite being 7 billion years old. Amino acids, various hydrocarbons, fullerenes, acids of various types. Again, if you know a little bit about biochemistry, these are, again, complex hydrocarbons, building blocks of life, which is amazing, 7 billion years old. Now, what this means, and this is part of the lesson tonight, is that we now have empirical evidence, in addition to the math, that the universe not only unfolds in an orderly way, but it unfolds in a way that produces, and I think you say necessarily produces, the basic building blocks of life. And from these, these basic building blocks, of course, life can arise. And life is, again, made up of the heavy elements such as carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. Could not exist prior to the second phase stars. And of course, from life, consciousness can arise. We don't know that it necessarily does, but at least that it can arise. This means that the universe seems to be, this is a loaded term, hardwired for the emergence of life as well as consciousness. Now here, we're in science, we're not in religion, but this is one of the conclusions of science. This is the basic idea behind what is known as the anthropic principle. Stephen Hawking, in that famous book, A Brief History of Time, is one of the people who kind of made this observation, and this is what he had to say. The laws of science, as we know them at present, contain many fundamental numbers. These are the basic fundamental values of the universe. Like the size of electron, like the size of electric charge of the electron, or the ratio of the masses of a proton to that of an electron. Those have set values. We know what they are. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. So, it appears from scientific research that the universe has been, and this is the language that's being used, finely adjusted or fine-tuned in order for life to exist. Now, you may know that the universe has four fundamental forces behind it that sort of constitute the physical universe. So we're going to look at those four in terms of this issue we're exploring. The first of the four fundamental forces in the universe is called gravity. And gravity has a particular numeric value. If the force of gravity differed from what it does by even one part in 1,000, you just tweaked infinitesimally, the structure of the universe would be drastically altered. Stars would not form. They would not live their cycles and die. And they would not produce then the heavier elements of carbon, oxygen, and the others. Therefore, we would not be here. Second, the strong nuclear force. Now, this is the force that holds the particles of the nucleus and the atom together, the neutrons and the protons. If this force was 2% weaker, it would preclude the formation of nuclei with large numbers of neutrons, therefore the heavier elements that constitute life could not exist. No oxygen, no carbon, we would not be here. If it were 2% stronger, go the other direction, everything would be converted to heavier elements quickly, and no hydrogen would be left over to make water. There would be no life, and of course, we would not be here. Third force, the weak nuclear force. This is the force responsible for hydrogen fusion forming helium. This is the power that drives the stars. Because it's weak, you can lose particles that leave the atom. If this force were any weaker, neutrinos would not be able to exert enough pressure on the outer envelope of a star in order to cause stars to nova or supernova, depending on the size, meaning, again, the heavier elements required for life would not exist. If it were much stronger, neutrinos would be trapped inside the core, and the star would not nova, producing heavier elements. Either way, there would be no carbon, there would be no water, there would be no life, and of course, we would not be here. The fourth force, the electromagnetic force. This is the force that binds electrons to the protons of the nucleus. Again, opposite forces attract, similar forces repel. So you have a negative charged electrons, positively charged protons, the electric magnetic force holds them together in the atom. If this force were slightly smaller, few electrons would be held in their orbit around the proton, resulting in a universe of only hydrogen and helium, simply the lighter elements. If this force were slightly larger, a proton would not share its electron with other protons and other atoms, which means we wouldn't have any molecules. Atoms could not bond together to form molecules. Change the EM constant, even minutely, in either direction, and the molecules necessary for life could not form. And again, we would not be here. Now, let's have a little fun. When you factor in more than one universal constant, it gets really interesting. Here's a chart with two. Across the bottom, you see the value of the electromagnetic force. That's the horizontal value. The vertical one is the value of the strong nuclear force. So we're only looking at two of the four forces. And you see what you get. Bottom down there, dark green, there's about half the space in there. Carbon and heavier elements cannot exist. Go counterclockwise, the lighter green, well, chemical reactions are impossible. Go over to the bright blue, hydrogen cannot form. Go down to the sort of flesh tone down below, stars cannot shine. You get a little box there where carbon-based life is possible, but only if the electromagnetic force and the strong nuclear force are at a particular point for each of them. So we have a very small window for the universe as we have it. And again, this chart simply attempts to lay that out. Now, we have identified a large number of universal constants. Here's some. These are things that have been measured and they are consistent. They're called universal constants because like the elementary charge, the fourth on top, it will always be the same. It simply does not vary. These are throughout the universe, these numbers hold true. And there's a large number of these. 26 of these are believed to be essential for our universe to exist the way it does and to exist in such a way that life can be here that we have. If even one of these constants was changed in even the slightest degree, the argument is the universe could not support life. Remember how small that box was with just two? Factor in 26, all of which would have to be just the right amount. And for the most part, most of these, when you change them, the life cycle of stars seems to be what falls apart. So just how fine-tuned is the universe? And this gets to be fun. And what are the chances of all of the constants being the way they are in the world or in the universe that we have today? The answer lies in what is known as the Penrose number. And a little background here. Sir Roger Penrose is a physicist, a mathematician. He's a close friend of Stephen Hawking. Roger Penrose and Hawking shared the Wolf Prize in physics in 1988. They're the ones who really came up with this whole concept of black holes. And their work laid the foundations for that, which we now have verified. The Penrose number is positive in the fact that these universal constants that we've been looking at could each have had any number of possible values. That physicists believe they don't have to have, I mean, they have the values they have in our universe, but they wouldn't have to have had that. That theoretically, the numbers could have been any number. So the Penrose number is the mathematical chances of the universe being the way it is so as to produce us. And so mathematically it's written this way. The chances are 1 in 10 actually 1 in 10 to the 10th, actually 1 in 10 to the 10th to the 123rd. Now, for those of us who are not mathematicians, what does that mean? Well, it means that the statistical chances of our universe being accidentally the way it is and supporting the emergence of life is essentially less than one chance in a million, trillion, trillion. Well, let's just shortcut it here and let's shortcut it again. You get the idea? It means that the chances that the universe exists the way it does, being due to blind, random chance, is statistically speaking, zero. And that's worth thinking about for a second. The alternative that physicists talk about is that the values of the universe are not the way they are because of blind, random chance, but that something, and here you get different language depending on which scientist you talk to, has picked, fine-tuned, or finely adjusted the fundamental values of the universe. That quote we had earlier from Stephen Hawking, that's what he was saying. Why is this done? In order for life and for consciousness to emerge over time. This implies that the universe is purposeful or purposive, that there is a design behind the universe. And logically, design implies designer. And here we're starting to cross over now into kind of religious language. That the universe was created by a designer for the purpose of life. We actually have physicists using this language. Of course, this is exactly what the creation story says in Genesis 1, though that is a narrative or story form, but essentially saying that the universe exists for us. The anthropic principle, anthropic from the word anthropos, which means human, or so it's the human principle, and the Big Bang, both reinforce the traditional, what's called the design argument or the teleological argument. Teleology simply means that there's a design and the universe has purpose and it's going somewhere. There's a direction to it for the existence of God. So the design or teleological argument for the existence of God. Even physicists use religious language. Let's put it this way. Even non-religious physicists have resorted to religious language to talk about the fine-tuned nature of the universe. So here's Paul Davies, theoretical physicist, one of the cosmologists today. The book was called God and the New Physics. The seemingly miraculous, that's sort of a religious word, concurrence of numerical values that nature has assigned to her fundamental constants, those things we looked at earlier, must remain the most compelling evidence for the element of cosmic design. In other words, the numbers themselves just scream design. This is Robert Spitzer's book, one of his books. Our universe should not be anthropic. The mathematical chances, remember, are essentially zero. Because the range of anthropic values, values that allow for life to emerge, for our universe's constants, is so exceedingly small, trillion, 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 remember all that, by comparison to the immense range of non-anthropic values, conditions under which life could not exist, this means that the random occurrence of the anthropic values of our universe's constants is so remote as to be virtually impossible. As a result, some physicists have begun to advocate that it might be just as reasonable, if not more reasonable, to believe that a, quote, super intellect, you know, very carefully avoiding the word God, but a super intellect, which, quote, set the values of the constants at the inception of the universe, as it is to believe in their random occurrence. Of course, not everyone agrees with this. By the way, this is another term for the anthropic principles. It's called the Goldilocks zone. You know, not too hot, not too cold, not too soft, not too hard, everything just right. So the Goldilocks universe. The result of some people not wanting to go this direction results in two possible explanations for the anthropic principle. There's more than two, but for us tonight, we're just going to do two. One of which is what we've been exploring, that the cosmos evidences design. The other approach does not argue with the math, does not argue with the Penrose number, does not argue with any of this. Rather, it posits a different solution, or another solution. What if, and this is a big what if, but let's just go with it. What if there's more than one universe? A multiverse. You've probably heard this language. What if there are an infinite number of universes? Now, if this is the case, if there's an infinite number, then every possible universe exists necessarily. That's what we mean by, you know, an infinite number, including the one that we just happen to live in. In other words, remember that trillion, 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 but all those universes exist. We just happen to be in the one where this is working for us. Even many scientists who do not believe in God do not support this multiverse view. Got a couple of good reasons. First of all, it cannot be empirically verified. Science, by definition, is limited to this universe. Any alternate universe, by definition, lies beyond this universe and therefore lies, by definition, beyond the realm of science, meaning you cannot empirically verify it. In short, any alternative universe would lie in the realm of metaphysics, that's the realm of religion, or just pure fantasy or speculation. These are scientific critiques of this view. It also falls prey to Occam's razor that the simplest explanation is to be preferred. So which is simpler? That the universe has a cause that lies beyond it, something that gives it design, or number two, that there's an infinite number of universes covering the all possible universes that can exist, and we just happen to live in the one that is hospitable to life. And there's, you can answer that. Now, Stephen Hawking, different book, made a twist on the multiverse argument. Of course, Stephen Hawking was not religious, so he's gonna be coming up with alternative explanations. What if the Big Bang was not the beginning? What if the Big Bang was actually the Big Bounce? And that prior to our universe, there was an earlier universe. Now, the idea is intriguing, but the weakness of the argument from a scientific view is again twofold. First of all, same problem we had before. Anything beyond or outside or before the universe we have is simply going to lie beyond science, which is limited by definition to this universe. So once again, this idea has left the realm of empirical science and entered the world of pure speculation or metaphysics. Fine, but it's not science. Second, our current understanding is that the inflation of the universe is actually accelerating. We've actually measured that. Current theory as to why that's possible is due to what we now call dark energy. Again, something fairly recent kind of idea. The data suggests that the universe, because it is not slowing down, which is what a big bounce would require, but is in fact the expansion is accelerating, the end of the universe, scientifically speaking, is more likely to be a big sigh than a big bounce. In other words, it'll just simply fade out infinitely over time. Now, the reply to Hawking's metaphysical argument against design, that there's a multiverse or a big bounce or something like that, here's a response to that. The response is that the design argument, which of course is a religious argument, is at least as plausible as the multiverse or big bounce theories. And many would argue that the design argument is actually much more plausible than these others. The simplest explanation, of course, being preferred. Now, one of the results of the discoveries in contemporary cosmology, which is still a young science and still cranking out a lot of information, is that it has stimulated a lot of discussion around the design argument for the existence of a designer beyond the universe. That's actually kind of a hotly debated topic. But for many, the most exciting development lies in yet another area of science, not in the realm of the very large, which would be the realm of relativity and the realm of cosmology, but in the realm of the very small. This is the realm of the quantum or quantum reality. And once again, we're going to find ourselves dealing with a topic raised by one of Einstein's papers in the miracle year of 1905. So next week, we will explore the brave new world of quantum physics.